is the best cure for malaria ever patented.
Malaria?
Yeah. Well, actually, little known fact that air conditioning was originally invented as a cure for malaria.
Really?
Because, yeah, I think it was like the 1800s, like 1850 or something like that, around that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually looked up the guy's name, John Gorey, in Florida. Apparently,
Florida would be the place the aircon would be, because they bloody need it.
Yeah, but like, this is back when like they didn't realize that malaria was spread by mosquitoes. They thought it was caused by swamp gas. They thought it was the humidity,
the bad air.
Yeah, bad air was what was causing malaria. So, and the guy John Gorey, he patented a way to mechanically cool stuff. He made an ice making machine, and he thought he could use that to somehow cool air and make the air better because they thought the air was what was causing malaria.
Mm-hmm.
So he invented air conditioning.
People do the smartest things for the stupidest reasons.
Yes, but yeah, best cure for malaria ever.
Like, what was the first aircon though? Was it like an ice block that blew cold air or something?
I think it was like ammonia, I think.
Yeah.
And like in water or something like that, like in a bath or something.
Yeah, we use Freon now because we know how to make it, and it's a better refrigerant. But back then, all they knew how to use was
ammonia. But
they knew it could be liquid and gas at close temperatures.
Yeah, because it just basically compressing it would liquidify and then decreasing it.
But it's really corrosive and it's not really good.
No,
but it works.
And it stinks,
it worked.
So.
Yeah, it stinks.
And it's poisonous. It'll kill you.
If it leaks, you're in big trouble. But mm-hmm. it works was the thing. And so
at least you'll die cold and refreshed.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Did I mention my refrigerator busted this
Seriously?
Summer? Yes.
Worst timing.
Oh
ever.
My God. Yeah.
Why does that always happen? It's like
it's because it's when it's needed the most. Slowly but surely, I was like noticing like the refrigerator is not as cold as it should be, mm-hmm. and then it like the refrigerator because American fridges they still have the freezer on top, right?
Not always.
Not always.
These days, like chest freezers, like especially also in the UK, like the freezer compartment is often at the bottom.
Okay, because that's.
But it's more common to have two separate things, right?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. for a freezer, and for a especially if your fridge is really large,
mm-hmm.
usually have the freezer on the bottom.
Okay. But
it's more efficient, right?
Yeah, because cold goes down. But it was gradually, like slowly, the fridge was slowly losing cool. It was like it felt room temperature, and then slowly the freezer was like.
Uh-huh.
That's not solid anymore. That's liquid.
It's like we were talking about in Japan, the worst thing to have is a broken refrigerator.
Oh my
because
God.
Because
getting rid of it is impossible.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, well, fortunately, it turned out the problem was that the defroster was busted. Like the frosting mechanism, the thing that's supposed to sense when it's like the frost is built up too much, was busted.
So the evaporator was freezing up.
Yeah.
I see.
And so the guy came, checked it and fixed it and was done in like 10 minutes. So it's just like awesome. So
but you have to pay to have somebody come and drain the coolant, and then you've got a giant useless box that you have to get rid of.
Oh,
it's like 300 pounds. So in Japan they don't have a lot of room to get rid of garbage. So you have to pay to get rid of large items that aren't burnable. So to get rid of refrigerator, I don't know, it's probably a couple hundred dollars,
probably, right? If it's usable, if it's not busted,
right?
Basically, if it's still like if it's something that's salvageable, then a recycle shop might take it.
Right.
But if it's gone, then you're gonna have to pay and just like
you have to call like the manufacturer, right? Like that's I think that's what you have to do. You have to call
responsible for.
They're responsible for disposing of it, but you pay through the ass for it. It's so expensive.
Yeah.
So we're actually, I mean, Tony is leaving Japan on September 1st, so we're moving out of these sweet digs, and I have to go live somewhere else. For a couple of months, but we are selling our stuff on Craigslist right now, and I have like a semi-popular like following on Facebook with my Craigslist post, like because I sell stuff on Craigslist like semi-regularly, and everybody always like asks me when I'm next going to be selling stuff on Craigslist because they love the drama that ensues. Because I don't know if this is the case in other countries, but for some reason the Craigslist like community in Tokyo is full of the biggest assholes in the world. Like they are the worst people ever. Like if you're the seller, you get these emails that are just like so incredibly rude and demanding. It's unbelievable. I'm just like, it's like a slap in the face across email. Because like, say I'm selling my fridge for like that fridge that we have is like a family size fridge.
Yeah.
That I got in the divorce from my ex-boyfriend. Well, it wasn't a divorce, obviously, but we split up all the household furniture, and I was like, I want the fridge. And I was like, okay, you could take the fridge. So took the fridge. I bought it with my ex for 120,000 yen. It's an expensive fridge. It has an ice automatic ice maker. It's got everything, right?
That
it's
is huge. Luxury.
It's like a 450-liter capacity. It's massive. So, like, okay, 120,000 yen. It's about 2 years old. It's working perfectly. I was like, right, okay, I'm going to see if I can get 40 to 50,000 yen for it, right?
Yeah.
So I post that on Craigslist with a bunch of other things, and of course the emails start, and I get a guy going, deliver it to my house in in Takasaki in Gunma.
Holy shit.
And I'll pay 50,000. I was like, bro, are you serious, man? Like, are you insane? Because that, the delivery will cost me like 100,000 yen.
Yeah. Fuck like, you. Just like, first need to rent a vehicle.
Yeah, right. No, he's like expecting me to organize Kuroneko or something, like a delivery service. And I'm like, if you pay for the delivery, you can have it for 50,000, but no. Yeah. And of course, no matter how many times you outline when it needs to be, because of course you can't just get rid of your fridge 2 weeks before you move out, right? Yeah. So I'm like, this can only be taken between the 25th and the 28th. Of course, you get people going, can I come look at it? Can I pick it up tomorrow? No! You fucking idiot. You need to learn how to read. God. People are so stupid. I just get so frustrated with it.
Well, when it comes to stuff like bargain stuff, like the inner asshole comes out from everybody.
Oh, yeah. If people think they can get something on the cheap, they'll just, their humanity disappears.
The lowballing is insane. Like, you list something for, okay, I respect someone who says, okay, I'm going to buy 5 of your things. Can I get a discount? Can I get a slight discount? Of course you can, yes. Okay, say it was 100,000, then I'm going to give it to you for 80 or something, right? But I'm listing this thing for 50,000, I get someone offering me 10,000 for it. I'm like, that's an insult. Like, go to a recycle shop and try that. No. So you have to put, like, no haggling on it or whatever. But, yeah.
Yeah, we had one. She got one email that was like, I'll take everything for half the price and 4 days late. Sorry if it's inconvenient. Ha, ha, ha. And we were both like, is this real or not?
It turns out thought it was real because that's the level of shit that I get.
It turned out it was her friend just trolling her.
But the fact that I didn't know for, like, two, because, you know, Craigslist goes through an anonymous email relay, so she thought I could see her email address, because I obviously know her email address, but no, it was like an epic troll, because it was so bad, and yet, like, I thought it was real for, like, 2 days, and I was posting it on the thread, and it got, like, 25 likes or something, and everyone was like, who is this person that's trolling you? This can't be real. And then she was like, no, that was me, I can't believe you didn't realize. But then 24 hours later, I got another email that was almost exactly the same, like, from someone completely unrelated, that was actually a real inquiry that was like, give me everything for half price, and you deliver it to my house in fucking Ikebukuro or something, and I was just like, it begins again. But hopefully we've moved a couple of things. Mm-hmm. But like, we were talking about fridges because we really want to sell it. But the problem is with fridges, secondhand fridges, it's a buyer's market because everybody knows that it's really hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
But it's a really expensive fridge and I want to get some money back for it. It's a good fridge. It served us well.
Yeah. If you're in Tokyo and you want a fridge, please check Craigslist.
It's the best fridge I've ever owned. I put that on the listing. And the ice maker is like invaluable for the next couple of months. It's awesome. Yeah.
God. Shit. If we hadn't gotten our fridge fixed.
Oh, you got it fixed? Yeah, are you sure you don't want to upgrade? Because this is really nice.
Well, also the thing is that, like, my house, it had, like, there's the measurement restriction, just like, what I've seen.
It's 182 centimeters tall.
It will not fit.
So it's probably taller than you.
Yeah. Yeah. It will not fit.
The same thing with our washing machine. When I came to Tokyo, I was thinking, okay, all these washing machines are really tiny. I think I mentioned this before. I think washing machines in Japan are just meant to keep women busy. Like, they just view it as women's work, so it's just got to be, like, they're just designed to be as inconvenient and annoying as possible. Like, the traditional ones you have two, like, a traditional Japanese washing machine has two chambers.
Yeah.
One chamber washes the clothes and wraps them around the spindle so that you can't get them off. And they're completely soaking wet. And then you have to take the clothes out. Oh, also, when you fill it up, it comes out of a spigot. It comes out of like a, you know, just like a faucet.
Yeah.
So if you just turn the faucet on, it'll just overflow. You have to fill up the washing machine and then turn it off.
Just to interject, those are really old-fashioned.
I've seen them.
Yeah, but hardly anyone has those anymore. Okay. Like, those are extremely old-fashioned.
The recent ones, it has built it. It'll stop. You can keep the faucet open, but it has a hose that goes and it'll stop it.
Okay.
But yes.
But the traditional,
the top-loading,
quote-unquote, traditional ones.
We had one of those at my study abroad dormitory.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Everyone just used the coin laundry instead.
Yeah.
And my grandmother's used to be one of those where you had to turn it off. But yeah,
it's like one step above a washboard.
Yeah,
and you have to be in the house while the cycle is going because otherwise it's going to overflow and ruin your house.
And then you take the clothes out after they're done washing; they're sopping wet.
Yeah.
You take them out, put them into the second chamber, and that spin dries them, and they're still not dry.
Yeah. And at this point, they've probably got holes in them from being like spun round and mangled at like 200 cycles per second or whatever it is, and like. In study abroad, we used the washing machine in my dorm a few times, and people got, like, holes in their clothes and stuff. So, yeah, it's made me super cautious about washing certain items. I'm like, I put it in a laundry bag, you know?
Yeah.
But, so, yeah.
So, anyway, I got a really fancy washing machine that has a built-in dryer and everything. But the thing is, in Japan, they don't use heated dryers with a vent.
No.
So, basically, the washing machine heats the laundry. All the water evaporates, and then there's a condenser that recondenses the water, and it goes down the drain. So it's
I love that you know this in so much detail. It's like the thing about being with an engineer. Like, they know how everything works, and it's really annoying. Because, like, in a conversation, it's really annoying, because with a normal person, you'd just be like, oh, yeah, you know, that washing machine's really, like, fucking weird. Like, I don't know what's going on in there. And your friend's like, yeah, man, I know. But with an engineer, they're like, let me explain that to you. And you're like, well, maybe I don't want to hear the explanation.
I'm reminded of the Dilbert cartoon where he's needs to get his TV fixed, and he's like, I know it, do it myself, but I know it needs like specific parts, and the repairman just like, here, take these. What are these? These are engineer pills. They'll knock you out until I'm gone.
Yeah, so true. Please. Anyway, the point of that story was the washing machine is really fucking big.
Yeah.
it's kind of hard. Like, we had somebody come over and look at it, and she's a diplomat, and she's like, I don't think this is going to fit in my apartment. And she's like a diplomat.
Wow.
Right? With a large apartment, we assume.
Yeah. And then our friend is moving into a new apartment.
Nah,
she needs one, but it won't fit. And
we're going to have to trash it, I think. I'm trying to offload it on, like, everybody on Craigslist. I'm like, you sure don't want to wash it?
Try calling a recycle shop.
Yeah.
They might take it.
Yeah,
it's working condition, right?
It works. Yeah, it works. The dryer's not great. I probably shouldn't say that. Sell it. But the dryer's
awesome.
The dryer's amazing. I mean, the clothes come out, they're dry, but you have to, like, they're not like fluffy, bouncy dry like they are in America, in an American dryer. Like, yeah, never
like
having
gas powered.
Yeah, they're not like fluffy, bouncy dry, but they're not. They're like semi dry. Like, mostly dry, and you just hang them up to air them out a bit, and then they're done.
So,
yeah. But, oh my god, I can't wait till I never have to hang up laundry again. I hate it.
It's such a difference. Like, doing a load of laundry, even when the dryer was working properly, doing a load of laundry in that dryer, in that washer dryer, would take like 4 hours.
Oh,
I go back to the States and do a load of laundry, and it's done in like an hour. Like, not even.
Yeah.
Because gas dryer.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So, yes. America laundry. Yes. Looking forward to it.
I love it. Oh.
Wow, so that was an interesting start for the Wayward Podcast.
Laundry. Laundry.
Yeah. Members here today include me, Toshi.
I'm Kat.
And Tony.
And so what have you guys been doing recently? Actually, you guys had a recent interesting, very
yes, speaking
trip.
Of air conditioning and cooling, I could have really used some this weekend.
Yes.
We took a trip, a bunch of friends, Kat and I and a bunch of our friends, took a trip to Nijima, which is, I think I talked about it on a couple podcasts ago. It's an island off the coast of Tokyo.
Yep.
It's about
where is it exactly, though?
It's about 200 kilometers south of Tokyo, outside the bay. So there's Oshima, which is a really big island, and then Toshima, and then Nijima.
Yeah.
And then there's actually three or four more after
and
that.
Sarugashima, right?
That was the last one.
Yeah, if people have noticed a sort of trend in those names that Tony was mentioning, yes, Shima means island.
Shima is island, yes.
Shima, or sometimes Jima, which is like where if the sign before it doesn't go with Shima, then it changes to Jima.
Yes, but it means island.
Yes.
So anyways,
yes.
Japanese lesson.
Yeah, so Nijima is literally new island.
Yep.
and you can take a 2-hour, what is it? Is it a hovercraft? What is it?
It's a hydrofoil.
Hydrofoil.
Yeah.
You can take a 2-hour hydrofoil from Tokyo Bay, but we chose to take the 8-hour
ferry.
Mm. Is it 8 hours?
It's about seven.
Seven.
Yeah.
We took the 7-hour ferry there, where you just like sleep on the deck or don't sleep, whatever.
I've been on one of those. I've been on several of those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's the cheapest option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really cheap. It's about $100 US, yeah, round trip.
And yeah, depending on the size of the ferry, you can like you drive your car into it, and you leave your car in the
you hole.
Can you do that on the Nijima one?
You can. I think you can.
Can you?
Yeah. I think you can.
Really?
The ship is the Salvia Maru.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other ship.
Japanese lesson. All Japanese ships are called something Maru, which literally means circle.
For
it's like HMS or whatever.
Most of them.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
Oh, there's some that aren't?
Well, military ships.
Military
will not
ships
have
aren't.
It. Well, not.
Ah, naruhodo. What are they called? Just anything?
It depends. Like, some of them are named after locations. Some, like,
so they're just a word. They don't have a. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Good to know.
But anyways, sorry about that. Yep. The ferry that goes to Kyushu, and the ferry that goes to Hokkaido, because those are huge.
There's a ferry that goes to Kyushu?
Yes.
How much is it?
I don't know the price, but yeah,
that
when
must
it was
take forever.
Not from Tokyo, obviously, but like from
I was gonna say
not
I'm from Tokyo Bay.
I took the one from Kobe to Oita about 10 years ago, and that one was also an overnight.
Yeah.
So it must have been really slow.
Yeah. I've ridden a few, and yeah, they're fun and at first and really boring.
Yeah, that's it. You're super excited. You're like, oh, we're on a boat. Oh my god! And you drink your drinks or whatever. You drink wine out of like a plastic container or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it gets to like 3 a.m. and you're like, oh god, please shut up. I really just need to sleep. I'm just dying right now. Okay, and something happened on the boat that nearly, like, destroyed Tony and my relationship, because anyone who knows me knows that I do not like waking up early. And what I really don't like, is being woken up for no reason. Okay. So, Nijima is almost the last island, I think. It's the second to third to last?
It's the third island.
Uh-huh. It's the third island. Okay, so there's a huge gap between the second one and the third one.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a big announcement that was like a Japanese song that goes like, do-do-do-do, you know, the announcement noise. And then the captain or whoever it is announces where we're going to land. So, finally, I get to sleep with my earplugs in, lying on the deck, like, wrapped in my sleeping bag, like, against the wall. I get to sleep at, like, 3:30, and then someone shakes me awake at 4:30 and is like, hurry, we need to get up. And of course I'm like, what the hell's going on? And then I listen to the announcement, I'm like, you idiot, it's not the right island. We've got like another 2 hours to go. We've got like 2.5 hours. And once I've been woken up, I can't really go back to sleep sometimes, especially in that environment. So I just lay there like seething for like 2 hours. I was so angry, and especially because I was super sleep deprived. I was hungover already.
Oh wow.
And oh god, I was so annoyed. And everyone else was still asleep.
Oh
my god, I was so angry. I didn't talk to him for like 5 hours. And then we did finally, we got there. And then, you know, I lay on the beach for a few hours and I felt better. But pretty much survived that weekend with very little sleep.
And did you get, I'm glad you got that out.
Yeah, well, I feel better now, so you know.
I of course have no comment.
Well, what did you guys do there, anyways?
Well, we set up. There's a, actually, if you like I've said before, if you ever get a chance to go, it's really cool. Expect not to be comfortable in terms of temperature. It's really hot.
Oh well, if you go in summer, yeah, we went in September last year, the end of September,
mm-hmm.
and it was the last nice weekend of the summer.
Ah,
it was like it was really freakish because the weather in Tokyo was quite cold. Actually, I remember wearing a jacket.
This year it was way hotter.
Because we went in mid August. We went in mid September last time, and last September was perfect. Like it wasn't too hot, but this time it was insanely hot. Like it was. I mean, I'm pretty tanned, and I'm a white girl from Northern Europe. So.
The sun is intense. I mean.
Yeah, like you have to be really careful not to get burned. It's like Okinawa style.
I mean, Tosha, you can look at my arms and my face. You can tell.
Yeah,
I got some sun.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, there's a huge campground, and it's like, it's well made. There's people there.
There's these two old people, this old couple that are really kawaii. Like they're like in their 80s, I think, and they maintain it, and they make sure that you're separating the garbage properly and everything. Yeah.
But it's all mowed. Like the grass is all mowed, really nice, and it is as the term goes, glamour camping.
Not really. I think glamping is hot water.
Yeah, but they've got showers.
They've got water showers, and they do have really nicely clean toilets, which is not something that you're guaranteed in any campsite. The toilets are really nice.
And there's a huge kitchen area.
Yeah, that's right. There's a huge kitchen area where there's like sinks and like gas stoves and like cutlery and basic condiments like salt and pepper and things. And it's all, you know, as long as you wash up after yourself, you can use whatever you want.
Outdoor barbecue grills and things like that. It's really fun. And it's really, like I said, it's only about $100 round trip on the ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Very cheap to get there. If you have camping stuff, it's really fun. We met several people there who were just there by themselves or, you know, just visiting. It's and you can also fly there for about the same.
There's a tiny airport.
Okay.
I know. Yeah.
You just take a turboprop and it's about 45 minutes. Wow. It's really cheap and really fast. And yeah, it's great. The beaches are so nice. Like people go to Enoshima and Miyuri Kaigan and you know, there's lots of beaches around Tokyo Bay, but none of them like this. Like I went for some reason, this particular campground is really popular with Brazilians that live in Tokyo. Okay. Like all the safety signs and everything.
Well, they come from Gunma, because a lot of Brazilians live in Gunma and places like that. Not many actually in Tokyo.
Right, but they come to Nijima.
Yeah,
because like all the signs are in Japanese, English, and Portuguese.
Yeah,
for some reason,
and not even Chinese, which is usually the other language that they go for. But this time,
about half the people
we were with a
Brazilian.
Couple of Brazilian. There were like two Brazilians in our group, two Brazilian girls, and we were meeting up with a Brazilian guy friend of one of them, and he knew literally everybody in the camp, so it was kind of like a giant Brazil fest. It was really good, fun.
So we went snorkeling, and just out off one of the beaches, one of the really clear beaches. There's one of the beaches that's actually just to the left of the pier where you come in on the ferry. Very, very clear. There's a little island that's kind of maybe 50 feet off the coast. You can snorkel around the sort of around the point of that island.
Well, you're not supposed to.
You're not
right?
supposed to.
We got called back by the lifeguard like four times
by the 12-year-old lifeguard. but we went snorkeling out there, and I could see, you know, 100 feet down.
Oh.
And there were these tunas or sea bass. There was just a huge school of them just moving past me under about 30, 40 feet down. It was beautiful.
I am 50% so jealous and 50% so glad I didn't do it.
I am terrified of
deep water.
Me too. I didn't. Tony's like, you should have gone. It was so beautiful. I'm like, no, fuck that. I'm scared of the ocean. I'm scared of fish. And I'm scared of drowning.
I can't even watch nature videos anymore.
Really?
No. Like the.
My God, Tony, come to my arms. You're another one. My friend Erin, you know.
Yeah.
She also, she's a pretty fearless type, and she's never like scared of anything. But she's like, I hate creatures in the ocean too. And I'm like, yeah. So we just floated around on giant rubber rings and like got suntan while they were like doing all this active shit.
I get the fear of it. Like I am also really afraid of really deep water, but deep water where I can't see the bottom.
Yeah,
like where just the continental shelf just goes off and you can't see anything. That does scare
me. So she's having like heebie-jeebies.
That does scare me. But as long as it's sort of gradual, then the sensation you get when you're snorkeling is kind of like flying, which is really awesome, I think. And especially when there's like lots of sea life and stuff, as long as it's not coming right at me, I don't care.
I can't. Like, I mean, when every now and then they'll have a nature movie at theaters, like I forget what though. I mean, several. This was like maybe 10 years ago, something like Earth or something like that.
Yeah, like there's a BBC one that was called like Deep or something.
And this was during a time when
it's like a
actively
movie.
Going like to the movie theater like once a week, and I'd like have to shut my eyes.
We should take Toshi to that and tell him it's a horror.
Okay, well it is.
Go to the IMAX
it
and watch
is.
It.
Oh God, an IMAX! Oh my. okay, no. Anyways.
Anyway,
yeah. So. But so you guys, I mean, what else went on there?
So we did that. We rented a car, which was I didn't think was going to work. I have an international driver's license, which don't tell anybody, but technically you're not supposed to have as a resident. You can get an international driver's license.
Sorry, I just kicked the microphone.
Sorry.
With a visitor's visa, with a 90-day visa. But if you have a resident license, you technically can't have one.
No Japanese person knows
but
this
nobody,
rule.
But nobody checks, and AAA doesn't check, so go ahead and get one if you're
Yeah, seriously, it's technically not allowed. You're supposed to take the Japanese driving test and convert your license as a special test, but nobody does it because it's really expensive and annoying. And
I have personal experience with this because I actually have a Japanese license.
Oh, did you convert your American license?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it's I mean, every driver's test has the written and the actual like on the road drivers. So when I took it, this is obviously like 15 years ago, but when I went and took it, the written was like a 10 or 20 question yes no question. Like quiz.
Right, is it a true or false thing?
Yeah, it's a true.
Right. I've heard there's like, so many trick questions in there.
But no, the thing is, like, so it was so fucking easy. I was like,
"Oh,
are
easy?
You even?
No way!
It was easy as hell." And they even said, "Like, do you want to take it in English or Japanese?" I'm just like, "English is my first language. Yeah, sure, I'll take it in English."
I thought the English was like really messed up and makes it hard.
You're thinking of the Genski test.
No, I'm thinking of the. Oh, maybe it's a different test to convert.
It could be.
Than taking the actual license here because I was considering. Because I don't have a driving license, and I'm 26.
Well, actually, I believe like actually getting a license, the test is much harder. But the convert for me,
right.
Like, oh, are you kidding?
It's like a person is crossing the road. Do you A, accelerate, B, stop?
Exactly. There was like you know the light turns yellow. Like
someone you really don't like is crossing the road.
it was pretty much like that verbatim, and it was just like, okay, you've got to be kidding me. And then I went to the actual road test, and I failed it twice. Because,
like, I heard the practical is basically just doing whatever the instructor wants to say.
Yes, but that's the thing. Like, the instructor says, like, turn here, go here. But if the instructor says anything other than where to go, you failed. If he says, like, you might want to slow down here, you failed.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah.
Nah.
Like, yeah, you might want to turn on your blinkers. You failed. Like, if they say anything other than the directions, you have failed.
You may as well just drive the car into a wall.
Yeah,
at that point. Fuck everything! Fuck you!
It's like in a video game when you're trying to do something without, like, the don't get hit.
Yeah.
Achievement or something, or, like, don't lose any life.
Yeah.
You just immediately plow into the nearest asteroid or whatever. Like, oh, well, fuck
I do that in Grand Theft Auto. It's like, every time I was like, oh, fuck, I just pull out a bomb. I pull out a sticky bomb, plant it down, blow myself up.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Just like, but, yeah, so I realized that, like, after the first two times that I was taking it, because you have, like, three people all get in the car with the instructor, and they take turns driving. Like, they go around the circle, come back, switch drivers, go around the circle, switch my drivers. And, like, I'd noticed that, like, the first time, obviously, like, I didn't think I'd fail, and then, shock, I failed for me. And then the second time, it's just like, let's find out why I failed. And I, like, started looking around, like, and then I made the connections, like, whenever anyone was driving, and the instructor said anything, like, aside from, like, turn here, go, anything, that person.
Were you observing or something?
Yeah. Well, no, like, you get to
see. You ride in the back?
Yeah, you ride in the back. Like, there are three people together with the instructor.
So it's best to go last.
Yes. And I went, the third time I went last.
Nice.
And not only that, I made sure the instructor didn't say anything. Also that, the instructor fucked up with his instructions, like, telling me to go. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, you need to go there. It's just like, yes!
Awesome. Gotcha.
Yeah, and so I passed that time. But yeah.
So, sorry, to go back to the rental car story.
Yes, sorry.
Okay, so Nijima, like any other country place, you really need a car to get around. There's a lot of bicycle rental shops, but if you want to try pedaling a no-gear bicycle that's really rusty, you know, across this island in 35 degree heat, then be my guest. We tried it last year. We were pretty fit by the time we left the island, but it was pretty miserable. Also, we had a ton of stuff to carry this time. Last time we went on like an organized group tour, so they were transporting the stuff for us. Mm-hmm. This time we had a ton of our tent and everything in our rucksacks. So we were like, right, okay, let's rent a car. So we go to this little car rental place, and it's this tiny old lady and her husband, who's also old. So they're like in their late 70s or early 80s.
Okay.
And I was like, right, okay, this is going to take some serious finessing, like some really polite Japanese. So I go in and I'm like, you know, super polite. I'm like, excuse me, hello, good day, all that stuff. You know, in Tokyo, you just walk in, you're just like, hi, I want a car. But it's
would
like,
you
hello.
Be able to, you know,
yeah,
if
it's
I could
like,
bar-
would you, if I could
bother you?
Sorry, Sam, sorry to bother you, like, gomen kudasai, all that stuff, you know, excuse me for stepping inside your shop. So then I was like, oh, hi there. We're just looking, we're a group of visitors and we're looking to borrow a car. And she was just like, okay, can I have your driver's license, please? And we were like, okay. And she said, how many of them are you? And we were like, well, there's eight of us. But she said, oh, the only thing we have is a six-person vehicle. And I was like, okay, that'll do. And she says, make sure and don't have eight people in a six-person vehicle. I was like, no, we'll do two trips. It's fine. So, you know, we're definitely not going to do something illegal. So then she kind of like, yeah.
We didn't do that.
Can we have your license? Shut up, Tony, go. And so we hand over Tony's international license, which obviously isn't a little card. It's like a piece of paper, like B6 size, you know, that yeah. you open and close. And she looks at it and she's like, wara, mita koto nai mono desu ne? Like, I've never seen this before. And I was like, oh, it's an international license because, and she goes, oh, you're foreign. And I'm like, yeah. You know, the thing with old people in the country in Japan is what my experience is that they don't notice you're foreign or they just don't care to the extent that they don't notice until it really comes up in conversation. Like, they will never say to you, oh, your Japanese is so good, because they just expect everybody to speak Japanese.
You made it this far.
You must speak Japanese. You know, you're in our part of the country, you must speak Japanese, you know? So it's kind of refreshing not to be told, like, oh, your Japanese is so good, all that. So she goes, oh, you're foreign. And I was like, yeah, he's foreign. It's Tony's license. So he's foreign, but this license has worked in Tokyo many times when we've rented a car, and it's totally legal. Here's all his personal information. Here's the Japanese translation page. She was like reading it, going, oh, okay, he's allowed to drive a car. He's allowed to drive a motorbike. I'm like, yeah, honestly, it's fine. So finally, she was like, okay. So she went to take a copy. And then the printer, the photocopier, of course, there was a paper jam. And she's like, Anata, like, darling, can you come in and fix the printer? And her husband, who's like just as old as she is, like comes in, like
hobbles in.
And he goes, oh, it's not printing. Shall I put in more paper? And I was like, no, I think it's a jam. Like, I said it as politely as I could. I was like, I think the paper's jammed. And he gets a pair of tweezers and he pulls out this like lump of paper. And then finally they managed to make a copy.
Oh.
And then they finally rented us this, like, it was a really good, actually it was awesome. It was like one of those vans. It was like a minivan.
Mm-hmm.
So it had more than enough room for eight people.
Was it like a Hiace or?
It was like a, I don't know, I can't remember the name of it.
With the really small wheels and like mm-hmm. really far forward. It was actually really fun to drive because you're sitting like right up. It was like driving a tiny bus. It was great. It was actually really fun. But yeah, it had totally enough. There was room for like 10 people. There just weren't seats for 10 people. But yeah.
So we kind of improvised.
It was fantastic.
It was able to carry all our stuff. So, I mean, also, I always find, like, as a foreigner, as a very visible foreigner as well, like being white, when you rent somewhere from a place like that that's probably never rented to foreigners before, because you, in order to rent there, you would have had to have spoken like perfect, like fluent Japanese, because there was no English, they didn't speak any English, like all the stuff was in Japanese, all the forms you had to fill in and stuff, and they probably just would have said no if you just showed up and couldn't speak Japanese. So you feel a lot of responsibility, like you have to return the car clean, not damaged, don't let them see you doing anything bad with the car. Not that we did, but, you know, we had slightly too many people in there. You know, because if you mess up, they're never going to rent to foreigners again. And they're going to be like, oh, foreigners always do this and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so you're very conscious of, like, that pressure.
It's not just you. It's just, like,
it's everybody. Yeah,
yeah.
Everybody's about to come after you and come to Nijima and try and rent a car. Because hopefully, thanks to us, because she seemed to really like us, because she was like, have a good trip. Take care back to Tokyo. Don't drink too much, kind of thing. And I was like, oh, thanks. She was really sweet, and hopefully she'll have a good impression of foreigners because of that.
Yeah, we came back the next day and we're like, can we have the car for one more day? And she was like, yeah, no, don't worry, you can. And also, she let us leave it at the dock so we didn't have to walk back to the dock.
Wow.
Which was fantastic because it's like an hour walk.
Yeah, generally you have to leave it where you
picked it up. Exactly. Like in Tokyo, you have to drop it off where you picked it up.
So we were planning, in Tokyo, you can't even drop it off at a different branch of the same company. You have to drop it off at the place you rented it.
You can, but it depends on the rental company, and you need to specifically specify beforehand
where you're going to drop it off.
But yeah, like, I think Nippon Rent-A-Car will
let you do that.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's good to know.
These places are all privately owned. Like, on the island, there's
they're
probably...
tiny. They're
like 1,000 people on this
they're
island.
They're like mom-and-pop shops. Yeah, they're tiny.
They're not
so
cheap.
No. They basically told us, yeah, it's very inconvenient. You can leave it at the parking lot in the at the ferry dock.
Because I was just, like, who do I give the keys to? And she said, oh, just put the keys up behind the, you know, the driver's...
The visor.
They only do that in the movies.
No, she would totally.
No, she, and I was like, really? And she was like, yeah.
I was just like, what?
And I mean, as I said to my friends, I was like, well, if this car gets stolen, it's not like they won't find out who stole it, because this island has literally like 800 people on it.
Unless they put it on a ferry, it's not like, going anywhere.
I'm still hung up on the behind the visor.
Country living, man. I mean, wow. It was so casual. We were like, okay, we're just going to leave the keys in the vehicle. Wow. Okay, are you sure? And I haven't had a phone call to say that it was stolen, so hopefully it was fine.
Okay, wow.
So, yeah. Japanese island living. It's great.
You mentioned, Tony, you mentioned that the population...
Oh, yeah. Like, that was another thing that, even more so on this visit than the last one, mm-hmm. that I noticed was just these islands and really even remote areas in the mainland.
Yeah.
But especially on the islands, it's noticeable. The population is so old. Yeah. Like, their average age has to be 50 or more. Like, I saw a few
I'd say more like 60.
I saw a few young people, but they were almost uniformly too young to leave home.
Yeah.
Like, they hadn't turned 18 or 20 yet.
There are no Japanese people over the age of like 18. Between 18 and 40, there was like none.
If you see them, they're there visiting. They're on vacation. Everyone who lives there is old. And it's I think in the next 30 years or so, those islands are going to be completely
abandoned.
It's going
to be like what was it? Gunkanjima?
I was going to say, exactly, because I mean, I was telling Tony this has already happened in certain Japanese areas and also the country. I mean, it's like in China, there's a huge population drain.
Yeah.
And so you're left with the old people and then they die off and that's it.
Actually, I think they made a point of the new live action Attack on Titan movie. They specifically filmed it on Gunkanjima.
Really?
Yeah, they specifically filmed it there. That was actually a news thing.
There's like zero people living there.
Yeah. So what was nobody there?
It was a work. I mean,
yeah, it was a blue collar.
Uncomfortably, at one point, it was like a work camp for people to mine coal.
Yeah,
and it under the ocean,
and it became abandoned completely. Yeah. And so there's literally no one there. It is like you're not really supposed to go there.
That's close to like Sadojima, like off the coast in Hokuriku, right?
Yeah,
it's north side.
I think the island's condemned.
You can't go. You can definitely not go in any of the buildings because they're super unsafe and they were constructed really shoddily.
I thought there was an accident that made everybody leave. It wasn't just natural population drain.
I would not be surprised. I don't
because I looked at it because I'm hugely into James Bond and I looked at it for the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I read the Wikipedia article and I think there was a big accident,
like a mining accident,
something like that, or there was a leakage of some poisonous gas or something, and everybody was evacuated. Yeah. So it wasn't like a natural population drain.
I see.
Yeah.
But it was like originally, I think it wasn't populated at all because there's no natural resources.
No.
But they built barracks there just to mine coal because they found coal seams under the ocean.
Right.
But then, it sort of dried up and it's now
a weird
abandoned place that people go to take cool photos.
Yeah. But and film movies, which are, speaking of which, because do either of you know Attack on Titan?
I know it. Like, I haven't. I'm not. I know. Well, I've read the first manga. Mm-hmm. I thought it was kind of too gory for me.
Yeah.
So, and it was actually really scary. I just never. I don't know. I kind of lost interest in anime and manga at that time. So
I watched the first two seasons of the anime, and I think it's pretty good. It's got a bit of that kind of filler. Filler scenes like people making super expressive faces and sort of grunting for 5 seconds constantly, but
That's also part. That actually is part to do with the director, who's good at doing. He's. I think somebody's called him the Michael Bay of anime directors because he's really.
Oh God!
He's really good at making like mundane stuff. He knows when to make something dynamic and like it really stands.
I have to say, I still do have some of those eye-rolling moments when it's like, oh God, it's not that dramatic. Like, no real person would react like this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think of anime I've seen, it's one of the best.
Yeah. It
and
is.
I love the sense of motion. Mm-hmm. Like, the way it's animated, really, it's very fluid, and it really gives you a sense of motion, especially when they're using the Jaeger suits and stuff, and they're sort of flowing through the landscape. It's beautiful.
It's insanely popular, so they made a live-action movie, which is very divisive.
Yeah, I mean,
reviews.
Like, based on what you've said about live-action movies, I don't hold out much hope for the acting.
No.
And it's like a B-class movie as well, because it's based on an anime, so it's going to be
but it's hugely popular,
that's
though.
That's the thing.
And it's got a ton of money behind it.
Yeah.
The special effects look awesome, so I'm hoping that it's going to be good.
Well, the special effects do look good.
And they look amazing. I'm just hoping
everything
the acting
I've seen
is going to be up to par.
Well, it's a Japanese feature film, so I wouldn't hold your breath.
It's a Japanese feature film, so it's a step above the TV films and the TV dramas.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But I'm not holding out. Like, I'm not holding my breath.
Can I interrupt quickly? I interject? Okay, I was at the gym just before we met up to record this, and I forgot my USB stick with my series that I'm watching while I run. Because I hate running so much, I have to look at something while I'm doing it because I hate it. So I was like, oh god, okay, instead of looking at the thing, seeing how far I've run, I need to look at something. So I turned on Japanese TV for the first time in literally 2.5 years. I made a conscious decision, this shit sucks so bad. I am not, after I broke up with my ex, I was like, we're not watching any more Japanese TV, no.
Oh, yeah.
So haven't turned the TV on except for to use it as a monitor. So I turned on the gym TV that's attached to the treadmill, and it's like one of those popular science corners that's on like a news broadcast, you know? And it's all about, oh god, Japanese TV. Okay, so in summer they're obsessed with Nichusho, which is heat stroke. They're obsessed with it. That's all they talk about. Every year it's the same bloody thing. And this was about heat stroke related to gaining weight in summer. It was like, they talked about heat stroke, and then they were like, well, people are scared of getting heat stroke, so they gain weight because of these things. And a couple of things they were saying were true, like eating too many sweets because they're cold and delicious, like ice cream, not exercising because it's too hot outside. Okay, fair enough. Japanese people do walk a lot, and in summer they tend not to because it's so hot. And then they were like, not taking a bath instead just taking showers. And I was like, okay, you were doing so well, because those two things, like not exercising and eating too much junk, those are causes of losing weight.
Sorry.
And then they're like, okay, so not taking a bath. And they were all like, okay. And then they started explaining it with like this terrible pseudoscience of like, taking showers makes you gain weight because with taking a bath, it heats up your metabolism so it burns calories quicker. I was getting so angry. I was like, this is bullshit. This is actually just lies.
Raising your body.
Oh my god, I was running while angry, which is not a good idea. I was like pounding it out, and I was like, this is just lies. I mean, how is this okay? And the fact that like millions of people watch this shit. This was like prime time, like 6 p.m. on a weekday afternoon. People come home and watch TV.
Yeah.
So I posted on Facebook. I was like, God, Japanese TV pop science is like literally the worst thing ever. And all these people were like, yes, 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 oh God. And I posted like, it's telling me that if I take a bath, I'll lose weight. And my Brazilian friend commented, she's like, did I read the English wrong? Or is that actually what it says? I'm like, no, it's actually what it says. Yeah. So, I mean, Japanese TV, I mean, the misinformation is just... it's just egregious.
We could do an entire episode.
We could, and I don't want to because it makes me so angry. I just can't. I mean, let's not even get onto the racism of Japanese TV. Let's just not. I just can't. I just can't. Okay.
Didn't somebody invite you onto a
TV you mentioned
show?
Something.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, one of my jobs is I'm a tour guide for, I was. I'm now more the admin side because I decided I was over it. But I was a tour guide for this quite popular Akihabara tour company where we dress up in maid costumes and guide people around Akihabara. It's called Akibaland Tours, which is it's really popular on TripAdvisor right now, actually. So I'm more about the admin at this point, but my boss / agent messaged me and was like, well, we got an invite to be on this program called Sekai Banzuke. And Sekai Banzuke literally means world ranking. Yeah, exactly. And I've watched it, like, back when I used to watch Japanese TV, those wasted hours of my life I'll never get back. I wish I'd been playing World of Warcraft, to be honest. And, seriously, the gold I could have mined in that time, so this program is basically, the whole concept is, we're Japanese, they're not Japanese. Let's look at the weird things they do and compare it to how we do things in Japan and be surprised. That is the concept. It fucking sucks. Excuse my language, because I'm just like, I hate this show so much. And usually if I don't want to do something, I never go on Japanese TV. I get asked quite a lot because I'm registered with a couple of these like agents and models slash actor agencies, and I speak fluent Japanese, which is quite rare to have like a blonde white girl who speaks fluent Japanese. But I'm always like, no, I don't want to do it, because there's literally no show, apart from possibly the educational ones on NHK, where they won't treat you like a sideshow. Yeah. Like, it's look at the monkey dance kind of thing. I'm like, hell no, am I doing that? No way. So I said to my boss, I'm sorry, I hate that show. No. And she's like, she laughed. She was like, did the Japanese emoticon for lolling? And she was like, okay, I get it. All right, no, I won't ask you again for that one. It's just, oh God, Japanese TV is just like a collection of the most talentless fucktards ever.
Oh God. Like, no, stop.
Like, I'm just going to quickly say this one sentence. That, like, they're gathered together to make banal comments about stupid things. That's literally all of Japanese. Okay, I'm done. I can't. Thanks for bringing that up.
Sorry.
So yeah, turned down Sekai Buns again. Then I posted that on Facebook and someone commented, oh shit, I was filming for that last week, and everyone was like, aha, good luck. There's also, have you seen Sekai ga mita Nihonjin zuma?
No.
Which is like,
I don't watch
Japanese TV. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Japanese wives at large in the world kind of thing. Like, it is kind of a rough translation. And it's like about Japanese women that are married to foreigners in far-flung places.
Mm-hmm.
Tony, what are you doing? Are you going to open that cookie? Because you better just do it right now. Because I can't stand listening to you open it quietly. Just open it. Look, okay, we're going to open it. Look. Okay. It's open.
Oh, now I have to eat it.
Yeah. When are you going to get in shape? You're drinking a beer, now eating a cookie. It's really bad.
Eat
the cookie. I'm going to eat it.
No.
Eat it.
Cookie's just my fault. Sorry.
Look, it's open now. You have to eat it.
Okay, I'll eat it.
Toshi was really Japanese and brought little snacks.
So
you're eating it. Because you were okay. We're going to open it. Stop eating.
Tony's crying and eating a cookie.
Stop crying and eating. That's the most pathetic thing I've ever heard. Like, I'm going to help you. Okay.
Okay.
I can't remember what I was talking about. Yeah.
The Japanese wives being tortured overseas.
No, so it's like Japanese women married to foreigners in far-flung locations, and basically the reporter goes there and is stunned that a Japanese woman could live in these conditions. I mean, I'm talking like Japanese women married to guys from African countries.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, really far-flung places like Mexico. You know, for a Japanese person to have got that far in the world. I'm not talking, like, the UK or America. I'm talking, like, really foreign places to them that aren't English-speaking countries.
Yeah.
And especially poorer countries, too. And basically, the whole concept is, why would you leave Japan to live like that? I mean, it is so insulting. It is so racist. It's just, I watched it and I actually got so close to sending like a formal complaint to the broadcaster, because I was like, this is racist tosh. I can't stand it. So that show, Sekai Banzuke, basically anything that features foreigners or foreign countries in any way, it's just unwatchable as a non-Japanese person, or even as a Japanese person with some kind of sensitivity towards like foreign cultures. It's awful. All
right. I was going to mention some more stuff, but this was good.
Just go for it. I'm enjoying myself now. I'm like,
it won't stop.
Blood up.
I'm like happily angry and I'm eating a cookie. I don't even care.
Okay. Well, let's steer this away. But actually, for my weekend, try to salvage before the rage overflows. But actually, my weekend, I went to, as I do twice a year, I went to Comic Con, the comic market. This one was the 88th comic market.
I saw the line for the... Someone, one of my other Japanese friends posted a picture. He wasn't interested himself in going, but he posted a picture of people queuing up for the first train that were obviously going to Comiket at his station.
Yep.
I think he lives in Yotsuya or something.
Yep.
And he was like, holy shit, there were like 200 people waiting for the train.
There are generally 10,000 people who wait overnight, and you're not supposed to do that.
Oh my god, you mean overnight at Comiket?
Yep, at the Tokyo Big Sight.
Did you say there were like 500,000 people this year?
This year, 500,000 participants, like people came.
Over 3 days.
Yep.
Do you buy tickets in advance?
Let's see. For Comiket, generally, admission is you need to buy the catalog. If you have the catalog, you can get in, basically.
Is there, like, a limited number of people?
It's basically,
an indie comic.
I've been once. It's for
doujinshi,
right?
Yeah, it's for doujinshi. It's for basically indie comics.
People. Yeah, fan-drawn comics. Yeah.
It's divided into 3 days. They definitely they divide the genres. Like, it changes. It varies. Like, what's on the first day? What's on the second? What's on? Generally, the third day is the adult material. But and that is the day that gets the most people.
The best day.
I would go on the third day. No, but like I remember there was like a couple of years ago there was a news story about parents being angry that people were coming home from Comic Con with these really like pornographic bags, like paper bag, like plastic bags to carry their doujinshi in.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough if their kid is at eye level on the train going like, "Mommy, what is that?" You know, I think the bags should be.
It is
plain.
A bit of a problem. They're trying to do something about that because I mean, as artists, they want to advertise their stuff,
right.
So what that's kind of like they do at game shows and other shows,
and they want people to be seen carrying merchandise.
Yeah, exactly. They want you to carry their swag. They want you to put your stuff in their bag, so people will see their bag.
People will be interested.
It's advertising for them, but that's kind of a problem because a lot of the artists go a little overboard. There are regulations.
Are there
on how much skin you can show, things like that? But people do push the guidelines to their limits, to their written legal limits.
Right.
It's one of the problems is that the Tokyo Big Sight, which is I don't know if it's the largest convention center in Japan, but it's one of
them. It's one of them for sure.
It is huge, and they've got I forget how many thousand different booths are there, all lined up, and it is a sauna. It is quite lit. Like the halls do have air conditioning, but it's a joke.
I've been to several conventions there, and even the less popular ones, it sucks. I mean, going there in summer is just the worst.
It is air conditioning is a joke, and actually this year, because 2 years ago, 2013 was the worst experience I have ever had in my life.
Oh my god!
Period.
Oh my god!
Yeah, like simply standing there, I was.
And you
sweating.
Paid for this?
No. I go there because one of my friends is a manga artist, and basically, can you help me sell books? Because it's hard to do on your own, especially because he's I don't know if you'd rank it, but he's basically mid level in popularity. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say he can sell. He sells about I'd say like anywhere between like 400, 500 books.
Whoa. At like 800-900 yen each?
700 yen a piece.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. He makes. Yeah, he's at right now. He's making a living doing that. Himself.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's impressive. Wow.
So,
what genre does he draw?
Pornographic, obviously.
Yay!
But the 2 years ago, 2013, there was literally. Because of the humidity and the heat, there was a fog formation in the hall.
Oh my god.
There are photos of this. Like, it was fogging up. I was just like, is this my glasses or is something in my eye? And I'm just like, oh my god, that's a cloud formation inside the fucking hall.
Probably from somebody's BO.
There's that too. But
other people's underarm sweat recondensing.
And people who have people who have been waiting in line for 24 hours and just it was nerd stench. But not only that, but just the humidity is terrible. I was like, I was sweating without doing anything, which
so
I
what's
hate.
What's a person to do, Toshi?
Well, there are a lot obviously a lot of people buy stuff those what are those chemical things that you break it would have
the
chemicals
cooling things
that mix and then it has a cooling effect, things like that. And people bring
that doesn't seem like something you'd do.
No,
you'd go the extra mile.
I went the extra mile. Yes, yeah, because I told you what I did. So I built a cooling shirt.
A good idea. Yeah. I love it. I don't know if you should talk about this because you might want to patent it at some point. Seems like something Japan would really go for.
It is actually something that does exist. The athletes use it mountain bikers.
Oh,
People who not motorcycle, but cycling.
Tour de France type stuff.
Yeah, professional cyclists, they use it. It's a shirt which has coolant that runs through it in pipes. And I this is an idea I'd been running through my head even before I actually learned these things actually exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, thought the idea because it came the idea actually came to me from liquid cooled CPUs and computers which use liquid coolant. So I thought, you know, why don't I try something like that? And so I had the idea of using a pump. I was considering using for an aquarium, like an aquarium pump. Hook up a pipe to that. Mm-hmm. Run the pipe through a shirt, like coil it around for like maximum, you know,
cooling effect.
Yeah, surface area, and then like running it back into a like having it all run into a bath of ice water to and from circulating like its own.
Like where would the ice water be though?
In a backpack, in a tank, or something like that.
This
was a very rough idea at first. So my first problem was I needed to find, like, first I figured out like a pump would cost around $20, like,
right,
just the pump itself. So I'd need a pump. I need to figure out like the measurements of the pipe, and then I'd get a shirt that's like, I don't know, a crappy shirt that I have that was like dying, just basically use that and put that all together. Okay, that was the idea. But I ran into the problem that most pumps run off, you know, DC current. Like they run off from a house socket,
mm-hmm.
and there are very few batteries that have that, like which will allow for a socket. I might be able to jerry rig something that, but that might be a little out of my league in engineering and very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want electric.
Yeah, carrying around electric current and ice water at the same time, probably a bad idea.
Yeah,
very cool, moderately cool dead butt.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm sure there are things like that, like, you know, batteries that will allow, that are powerful enough to power a pump for a extended period of time that you can plug in, like, a socket, which have a socket you can plug into.
Mm-hmm.
But those seemed, you know, just from the pure logic, those seemed exorbitantly expensive and out of my budget range. So I was looking through my local hardware store, looking for a pump for an aquarium and the piping I need, and I found a weed killer spray, a battery powered weed killer spray, and I was just like, it had a like a 5-liter tank connected to it.
Uh-huh.
I was just like,
this is fascinating.
I was just like,
this is like genius invention motion.
Guys. Okay, so this is battery powered. That would solve my battery problem right there. It pumps weed killer, pumps fluid out. So if I switch out the hose and make the hose circulate back into the tank, I'd have and just basically run it through a shirt.
Or you could get like a foot pump, like a tiny foot pump, and put it in your shoe. And as you walked around, it would pump the liquid.
That's a really good idea.
Around your shirt.
Is that serious?
Totally. I was totally serious.
Yeah, but obviously because I'd be standing in the location, that's.
Because you were going to be standing.
Selling, yeah.
Were you going to walk around the
I mean, I do walk around. I do. There are several other
peruse,
other artists.
Peruse the adult material.
Mm-hmm. That too. And see, there, I do have like several friends.
Okay.
Who artist friends who
That's
I
cool.
generally see. I only get to see them twice a year because Comic-Con only happens twice a year.
Right, right. So, and of course, people come from all over Japan to do this, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I bought that. I found the right size tubing that I could like remove.
Uh-huh.
Remove first the tube that was there, and then switch it out, and then built it. And then I had to figure out like how long will this last? Like I don't want to use single like small ice blocks because those will melt faster. I want one large chunk of ice.
Mm-hmm.
So I filled it up like two thirds, three quarters way full, and froze that.
Yeah,
one large block of ice. Then put water in that, and then did a field test, see how long it would last. And from solid block with water to no longer like room temperature, it only lasted about like two, maybe 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
So a little impractical on the length, like on the, you know, how long it would duration, but it like actually using it. It would cool someone down.
Well, the body uses a lot of heat.
Yeah. So
it's a really cool idea. I'm really impressed that you like invented that yourself.
And I actually did a field test of it, and it worked.
Good.
So
and everyone else, you're just like sitting there, like in your cool little like bubble, being like, "Huh, sweating fools."
Seriously, I think like if you could make that practical and cheap, that's something you could sell at the door.
Oh yeah.
At any Comic-Con or
Comic-Con.
I mean, Toshi's right in that I have seen similar things. I think Uniqlo had something similar, did they not?
Possibly.
Like, I've definitely seen shirts that you can, shirts that have, like, a place in the back and front that you slot, like, an ice, one of those hard ice packs in. But again, that's only going to last for, like, an hour.
Yeah. If that.
If that. Yeah, exactly. And the weight of it is also an issue.
Yeah. Let's see. Problems I ran into was one, obviously, the length, because I needed to bring it, like, first I need to freeze the ice. There was no place to freeze the ice at Comic Con, so I need to freeze it at home, and then I need to use, like, tin foil and stuff like that to basically, you know, insulate it and keep it cold, and then I'd still have to take it all the way to the Tokyo Big Sight, so some of it would start to melt. Mm-hmm. I could not stop that, so, and then I'd have to put water in, and I need to make sure the water that goes in was cold, because I didn't want to put hot water in, because that would make it melt faster, things like that, and I was thinking all that, so it lasted about an hour and a half in terms of the duration.
I've got my engineer brain going now. I mean, it's boring to, like, a lot of people, but I think this is so cool. This is such a good idea.
All I was complaining about was the conversation being derailed by unnecessary scientific explanations.
Okay.
Not you particularly, but certain other people that are engineers or scientists are really bad for that. Like, you'll be talking, just like shooting the breeze with somebody, like three or four of you, and like, that is not the time to show off how much you know about photosynthesis or something. I mean, I picked photosynthesis because that's like the only thing I can remember from science at school, but yeah.
But yes, so it, I mean, the second problem I ran into was that because it's running ice water, which is, it's like, first of all, the temperature regulation is very difficult. So it's running ice water through this piping all around your body, and if you're wearing only a thin shirt, it can get pretty cold pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would think it would be
quite
cold.
Yeah, I mean, if you can control, I also want to change the location of the switch, because the switch is on the thing itself, and I had that in
my
bag.
Did you have the tube actually, like, in contact with your skin?
Not in contact with my skin. I was wearing a shirt underneath.
I was thinking, like,
in contact would be way too cold.
Yeah, like, you need sort of, it's kind of like a catch-22, because you need the padding to
prevent
spread
it from
out
too
the cold, but at the same time, you don't want it to be insulating, right?
Yeah.
So, because once it runs out, you're going to be miserable.
Yeah, so I need some kind of Under Armour shirt of, like, the right material.
Either that, or it has to, like, wick away moisture from you, and
Yeah, so, I mean, my friend, when I showed him this thing, he equated me to, like, Tony Stark. He equated me to Iron Man. It was just like, you built your own cooling shirt.
That's a really cool comparison. You're like, yes, thank you. Amazing. Yes, I am.
Yes. So that was my experience. I'm probably going to write an article about this.
Oh, you should totally share. That's really cool. And do a diagram and stuff. Like, patent pending.
Because it was fun. It was a bit, like, I mean, it made what is generally a very hot and muggy, I mean, albeit fun, but a very hot and muggy experience a lot more bearable.
Oh, that's good.
And enjoyable. So, yeah, that was my weekend experience.
Otsukaresama.
But actually, moving along a bit, actually, one of the topics we wanted to discuss was movies that Tony and I are going to be talking about. I also want to talk about, because since last time we had a podcast, I went and saw Inside Out, the new Pixar movie.
I want to see that.
And there's something I want to mention, because this is specific only to Japan.
I'm like saving up all my movies to just watch when I leave Japan, because I'm just like, I'm tired of Japanese movie theaters.
Well, I'm no spoilers or anything, but Inside Out, it's great.
Everybody said that.
It is possibly, it is like, might be in my top three, maybe, of Pixar movies, because it really, it hit home.
Everyone said it's amazing. I only have a very vague idea of what it's about. Like, emotions, and I only know that because one of the apps I use has targeted advertising, and it's an Inside Out advert in Japanese, and it's like, I'm sadness, I'm gonna go cry.
It's a great movie, but in the theaters in Japan, before the movie plays, they have a little thing specific.
It's like, caution, you're about to see emotion. We know this is unfamiliar to many of you.
It's worse than that. They have the Japanese version, as all Disney Japanese versions of Disney movies do, they have the Japanese theme song.
Have a Japanese theme song?
Yeah.
Oh,
they have a Japanese, and I thought it was
the recorded in Japanese with Japanese singers kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I thought it was an English, like, the English, I didn't know, like, when I first heard about it, I thought that, oh, this is the English theme song with Japanese lyrics.
That's usually what it is, right?
It's like, not in this case. I don't think so. Because I, watching the movie, there was never anything that would indicate that
okay.
that theme song songs that. But they have a, it's by the group Dreams Come True. I'm
Doricom, yes.
Yeah, they're fairly famous, and they are good.
They're really old.
Yeah. Yep. They're almost classic rock.
Nice,
I guess
like 90s, right?
Yeah.
Like late 90s.
But this and the song, it basically plays with images of children, like with all sorts of different, like live pictures of like all different people's children showing different emotions, and it plays this song, and it's just the worst fucking thing ever. It's like
worse than okay, I put it to you that the song that fucking Ed Sheeran recorded for the Hobbit. I see fire.
Yes.
Inside the mountain.
Okay,
that's the worst song I have ever heard. I actually stood up and laughed while the credits were going. I was like, Japan, I know you, in Japan, Japanese movies, everybody stays to the very end of the credits, and the lights don't go up till the very end. Yeah. But I actually got up and left because I could not stand that shit.
That was part of the movie. That was part of the English release.
It was, I know, but I just, because I saw The Hobbit here, I'm not blaming Japan for that one.
Okay,
I'm blaming Ed for that one.
Okay.
So awful. No. And apparently he was boasting, Ed, I think his name's Ed Sheeran, right? I think he was boasting that he wrote that song in like one night, and I was like, no shit. It's terrible. You know the song I'm talking about, right?
I actually haven't seen the third Hobbit movie.
It's not, I think it's in the,
it's the first one.
It's in the first one. The theme song.
Oh!
There you go, yeah. Right?
Okay.
Over the end credits.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, it was, because it's like.
So I put it to you that one is worse.
It's this
this
one
is pretty
was
bad. Okay.
Yeah, it was just like, what the hell are you doing?
And it's at the beginning of the movie, so you can't even leave.
No, it comes before. First off, it's like, why are you trying to prepare me?
You're like, I need some popcorn. I forgot.
Yeah, I was just like, what? Like, it has like, I'm going to be feeling emotion from this movie. This movie is that good. So it's like, why are you doing this?
Oh, so they're trying to make you feel more manufactured emotion.
Yeah, okay. It's very, very conceited.
I hate that.
Yeah,
Disney is like that. It's so manipulative like that.
And it's,
this is where you cry.
And when you hear the lyrics, it's just like, I don't know how properly explain.
Japanese sentiment is so in your face. It's like hit you over the head with a mallet.
It's
like
not
subtle.
Just that. It's also, it's like, it's like musicals when they're singing what they're doing.
Right.
Mm. They're explaining. The lyrics are like that.
Yeah.
And one, it's not only that, it's also, you know how, like, what is it? Mr. Children. You know the group.
Miss Cheater.
One of their signature things that they do in all their songs is that they'll sing like lyrics which have more syllables than the actual notes.
Right.
They'll have they'll have compressed lyrics.
Right.
This was that, but done very badly.
Right. Okay.
It's just like, okay, you couldn't fit in everything you wanted to say.
So it just doesn't
scan. So you
scan.
Just crunched it.
Okay. Cool.
And it's just like, oh my god. So I'm actually gonna run that as their ending.
Oh,
things.
Are you? Oh,
I'm
brilliant!
See,
so everyone has
that.
To judge.
Yes.
Okay.
It was because it's like a lullaby to the main character. It's the song title is Itoshi no Rairi. Yeah, the main character's name is Riley, and it's like Itoshi no Rairi was basically
like,
lovely,
dear Riley,
basically. Mm. And one of my friends who saw the movie basically said, okay, I took that as a nightmare the main character had. That's not, okay, because it's like a lullaby to the main character. It's like, okay, I'm seeing that original, that first song, that was a nightmare the main character had. Because
now you make me want to see it.
It was because I facepalmed in just before the movie started, and like before the movie starts, they have they always, like, because it's a Pixar movie, they always have the shorts. And this one, the one they have is, I won't say it's not as good as some of the other ones they've had, which are really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
But it hits some of my buttons that really get me, like, emotionally.
Is it a silent?
It's a song. It's like the whole. It's a song. The whole thing is a song.
Oh, okay.
And it's a sing about. It's singing. It's called Lava, and it's a song about a mountain, a volcanic island.
Mm-hmm.
And but one thing, as I've gotten turned into an old crotchety old man through my, you know, with movies, is I hate it when they'll kill a character like to. You know, basically to force an emotional response.
Just
to the
punctuate emotion.
Yeah, I hate it when they kill a character to do that. And my thesis is don't kill a character. If you want an emotional response, a genuine like emotional response from me, don't kill a character. Kill his dreams. Like, kill the character's dreams. Like, I'm sorry, spoilers, but...
No, I get it.
Monsters University, the sequel Monsters Inc. prequel, they do that. Like, nobody dies in that movie.
Uh-huh.
But they kill a character's dreams, and I was weeping openly when I saw that in the theaters.
Yeah, we have the same conversation about Game of Thrones constantly, which is, you know, one of my favorite series.
Yeah.
But their punctuation, like, they use violence and rape and, like, in very clumsy ways just to, like, make you feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't actually advance the story in any way. It's just like, look at this horrible thing that happened. We want you to feel bad right now. And it's just like, this is just lazy writing. Like, killing a character just to make you feel bad at a particular moment. Like, there's a formula for movies. Like, if you've never listened to the Cracked podcast, which I think I've mentioned before.
Yes, yeah.
They talk about punctuation in movies. There's an episode about, like, formulas for movies. The moment in the first Star Wars movie, A New Hope, the first old one, the moment where they land on the Death Star is exactly the midpoint of the movie. So it's like the turning point of the movie, and like you can time it down to within a few seconds. If you look at the total running time of the movie, the action point of the movie, from the moment that it opens with the Star Destroyer chasing Leia's Corvette to when they land on the Death Star is exactly halfway through the movie. Like, and there are just punctuation marks throughout movies where they figure that this is the formula that movies have to follow. And when movies use that formula, they're like, well, something's got to happen here, so I guess we just need to change the script to just make this guy die, or let's assault this character, or like let's do something horrible to this woman. Like, you're just making up for your bad script. you haven't thought it through.
Yeah.
Like,
so yeah, I mean, it's all about the organic nature. Like, if it doesn't have to follow, like, who was it? I think it was John Peters. Is like you have to, like, every 10 pages there has to be an action beat. He was a producer of, what was it, the Batman, Tim Burton Batman, and like, actually, this is because I saw the documentary, like, whatever happened to Superman, like the death of Superman, what happened to Superman, like, the movie, and John Peters show up, but like, that was one of his things. Like, every 10 pages, you have to have an action beat, and it's just like, no, you don't.
No. I mean, but there is a certain rhythm to movies and comics and pretty much all media that, yeah, it works. People respond to it better, but if your writers are good, you can have horrible things, and you can have bad things happen in movies. You can have horrible things happen in movies and make them serve the story, right? And make them count and make them meaningful. But like, if you're just doing it to make people to like bust up people's feelings, then that's just lazy. Like, but that seems to be a lot. Like, that's a really and it's very effective. Like,
yeah, it's a really
popular formula now, for especially for premium TV and like cable TV, like shows like Game of Thrones, Mad Men, House of Cards, Breaking Bad, all these things. Like, it's all about building you up to let you down.
Yeah.
Right? And if the writers aren't... And I think Breaking Bad is an example where they didn't do that, because everything horrible that happened served a purpose in the story.
Yeah.
Generally.
Oh, yeah.
It was central to the plot, right? But, for example, when they kill Roz in Game of Thrones, it's just another plot point to show how horrible Joffrey is. I'm like, we already knew that. We didn't need you to, like, murder this girl to teach us that lesson, right? That's just lazy.
Yeah. But, sorry, we were talking movies.
Sorry, just got distracted, but...
No.
Yeah. Your point about making people feel emotions for no reason, but just to make them feel sad or happy or horrified or whatever, is just like, what are you doing?
Yeah. So that was, I mean, so
if you get a chance to see Inside Out before you leave Japan, please.
Oh, I definitely want to see it in the theater.
But bear in mind, and I actually want to hear your opinion on this.
Toshi, I'll put it on Facebook.
Because I was just like, I almost in the theater said, "What the fuck are you doing?"
And all the Japanese people are like, "He's not a real Japanese person. He speaks English."
Yeah, he's talking in the
theater. He's speaking in the theater. Yeah. And he's speaking perfect English. Stone him.
Yes, but
on that note, I'm gonna have to leave you guys because I have somewhere to be in like half an hour. So I'm about to cycle through
Tokyo this night. Is as good a point as any. We're gonna cut off the podcast right here. Like this is a good because I'll say now. We're gonna cut off the podcast. And we're going to end it with a musical, musical
the
piece.
Music we've been talking about.
Yes, and after that, Tony and I are going to come back for spoiler talk because this is some stuff we've been wanting to talk about.
Yeah, because I haven't seen what was it?
Terminator.
Mad Max, I have seen, so we could talk about that. But
and Terminator Genesis.
Terminator Genesis, I haven't seen and don't really have an interest in. So you guys go nuts. But well, thanks for listening to me talk about things that make me angry, guys. Start a new podcast about things that piss me off, but once I leave Japan, there'll be nothing that pisses me off. Anyway,
so this has been a Wayward Podcast. I'm Toshi.
I'm Kat.
I'm Tony.
And we'll catch you next time. Mad Max Fury Road.
Yes, great movie.
Yes.
Loved it.
Would you call it that your favorite this year?
That I've seen in theaters, yes, because I don't see that many movies in Japan.
Okay.
But overall, yes. I think my Facebook post was, I forgot to eat the rest of my popcorn.
Yeah.
it was fantastic.
Yeah, you said you hadn't done that since when?
I can't remember. it was just so... I was just so focused on it, and I couldn't get a break to, I was so immersed in it that I didn't realize that I had popcorn left to eat.
And, we said this earlier, but this portion is going to be spoiler-laden.
Yes,
spoiler-laden. So, actually, this goes back to one of the things I said earlier before we cut off was the don't kill a character, kill their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And that was...
Oh, yeah.
That was one...
Mad Max does that excellent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was just like... The template for that,
just destroying a
character's dreams, and yet the whole comeback from that also, and all my friends have, all my Japanese friends have been loving it, and actually they have a thing going on. Okay, I wanted to see it in 4DX, but I didn't get to. But they have something at one of a theater. Relatively famous theater in Tachikawa, where it's called the Bakuon Joe, which literally translated means explosive sound showing, where they have a really nice sound system and they crank up the sound.
Really?
They did this with the Expendables 3, and I saw it there, and sound, obviously visuals are very important in a movie, but sound is almost equally important for the theater experience, I've discovered. If the sound is amazing, that's something you can only really get. If you've got a great sound system at home, then probably yes, but having a huge room dedicated to booming sound of a movie is an amazing experience. And so they have
the theater in Tachikawa, which they just crank up the sound beyond like what normal theaters do. They like mm-hmm. just it's, so all like the huge bass and like
single screen. I
see. Yeah, okay. But it's only one screen, and they've been sold out every single day. There's still
Mad Max.
Mad Max came out in theaters how long ago? Like I mean, we saw it last month. Yeah, it's like they're still playing it.
Yeah,
it's still going on. Most theaters are going to continue playing until like the end of this month.
That's so impressive to me that a movie, a foreign language movie in Japan, can go that long, which just goes to show you that it's really not thematically complex.
No, and
it's well done.
Yeah, right?
Like,
and
the
it's
fact that you can bring it to a market like Japan and have it be that popular.
Yeah, it wasn't. The marketing for it was not all the in your face, see it everywhere you go sort of thing. But
yeah.
The word of mouth, the Twitter sphere, as it were, just basically mm-hmm. served as its advertising,
which is fantastic.
Yeah,
because I think that just goes to prove that the way that movie was shot and the theme in that movie are so universal.
Yeah.
It's like the success of Frozen
mm-hmm.
in the sense that totally different cultures can completely lose themselves in it and enjoy it for what it is without tons of, you know, without the subtitles having to be finessed or having to get over certain cultural expectations. Like, the movie itself is pretty simple.
Yeah.
But it's so well done that it can appeal to anybody.
I think recently, within like the past week, a picture came out where it was, George Miller is the director,
mm-hmm.
his original like layout, first draft of the movie was dated. They made like drawn in 1999.
Really?
And it's like pretty much very little has changed of
really?
the story layout. I think like the character Nux, which is, this is another thing. Apparently, like, the pronunciation of his name changed the movie. Like, he introduces himself as Nukes, and at first it's Nukes, and then later on it's Nux. I may have heard it wrong. I will say maybe I heard it wrong, but I heard it as Nukes at first, and then Nux later. But anyways, but like apparently like he had a brother, and that brother dies in the movie or something like that. It's like there's all the stuff. There's actually a scene where when they reach that sort of like dead marshland where there's people walking on stilts, and apparently there was supposed to be a scene where they like there's a fight with them, like with the people on stilts and things like that.
I thought it was nice that they didn't interact with those people. I thought they were such a unique
it was poignant
landscape.
Yeah.
That the thing I you know, Sarah and Kat have taken me to task for my obsession with world building and like how, and I can see the point. Like it does tend to get too explanatory, but having hints, like hints at the world that a movie or a book takes place in without explaining everything,
is such a
finessed thing that if you do it properly, it's so effective.
Yeah.
But if you do it poorly, it's so bad.
Yeah. Well,
in that case, like avoiding that fight scene, you just made them part of the background, and then you're left wondering, well, what is this all about? I love that, how it expands the world without explaining it.
It's the movie does a lot of things that, like, for one thing, like I looked it up, and there's an amazing backstory to like Immortan Joe himself.
Yeah, he was like a hero in
Colonel Joe Moore.
Yeah.
And like
They have the comics now, so that goes back and explains a lot of it, right?
Yeah, and like the things like, and these are things that actually show up in the movie also, but they don't say it in the movie, so you if you didn't know this stuff, you wouldn't know. You don't know, might not notice them as much, but like the Joe and the other two guys, the other two leaders of the Gastown?
Gastown
and the Bullet Farm,
yeah.
The leaders from them, they work together to get the Citadel. They originally, like,
they took it over, right?
Yeah, the leader of the Bullet Farm and Joe, basically they captured the guy who became the leader of the Fuel Town, and he developed divulged the location of the Citadel.
Right.
And the three of them together, they got it.
Remember something where Joe got captured or like surrendered or something, and he survived under miraculous odds?
Yeah.
And that's why he's called Immortan Joe.
And also the thing is that because they were like they did it together, so that's why they're the three leaders.
Right.
But because Joe and the Bullet Farm leader were closer than the Fuel Town leader, the people leader, whereas the Bullet Farm leader will call Joe brother, the Fuel Town leader will not.
I see.
It's like you notice that in the, if you're knowing that and you watch the movie, you sort of see that relationship also forming. And there, I love the names of all the characters.
Yeah, the naming conventions and like how weird.
Yeah, I also love that. Splendid. Her full name is Angran the Splendid. I think that her name is. But and at one point, Joe calls her by her name, Angrand. It says, like, that's my child. But you don't really notice it.
Glossed over.
Yeah, it's sort of glossed. You don't notice it. And it's only if you're looking at the credits, it's Angrand the Splendid. And they don't dwell on that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make it a point to say that stuff, but it's there.
It's exactly like we were saying before with the Swamp People.
Yeah,
it's part of the environment. It's part of the mystique and part of the world.
But all the character names, like aside from just Immortan Joe, but just like his kids, like Rictus Erectus, and his other kid is Corpus Colossus. And just like the guitar player is the Doof Warrior.
The Doof Warrior.
And just like reading those names,
it's like if Australia hadn't been colonized by the British, if it had been colonized by like actual weirdos, like uncivilized weirdos, then it
like prisoners from England.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, the British colonies in Australia were all supervised by colonial overlords and like keeping order. It's like, what if we just sent them off on boats to govern themselves and just let them captain their own boats and
and
they would have
themselves?
They would have come up with shit like that, right?
Like, I think like Joe has a third son who shows up in the video game. I don't remember his name, but it's also like another weird name.
You know, mentioning this kind of like lore minutia.
Yeah.
If you look, I got really interested in Immortan Joe's medals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has these insignia and medals on his uniform,
on his plastic armor plate. Yeah, muscle plate.
And if you look closely at them, if you look at the props, they're all basically. And it's such a good metaphor. They're all basically junk. Hmm. They're like symbols from like Cracker Jack's boxes or like little trinkets. Huh. One of them is like a hood ornament.
Well,
They're not actual military honors. They're garbage.
But they've been put together. It's the thing that the mask that Max is wearing, like for the first third of the movie, that muzzle.
Yeah,
that is actually, if you look at it, the three prong thing, that's a garden fork.
Is
and
it?
Somebody actually found like what it is. And I was just like, it's a garden fork that's been welded together with other metal to make a muzzle.
Right. But I like, especially the metals on Joe's armor. I liked the symbolism of him, of them being garbage.
Yeah.
Because his whole authority is garbage, right?
Yeah.
His whole claim to power is manufactured, right?
Yeah. And but also, there's I like the fact that obviously this is not in the movie at all. I mean, this is something that never comes up in the movie. But the fact that looking at his story, what he believes he's doing is right. He believes he's doing genuinely. He genuinely believes through and through, as fucked up as it is, what he's doing is for the better good of humanity, like to preserve the pureness, like, you know, because after the fallout, like, you know, basically people with deformities, and so many of Joe's kids are all deformed or, you know, have problems. Like, Rictus is really, it's the Master Blaster thing. Rictus is really powerful, but is like, has the mind of a child. And Corpus Colossus is really smart, but he's obviously, he can't move on his own. He's like, you know, he's deformed.
He's the
kid with the beard.
Right.
Yeah. He's the kid in like, in
who at the end of the movie is basically crapping his pants. Oh shit, what are they going to do to me?
Yeah, yeah. But
did you learn that from the comics?
I learned it like reading his backstory.
Okay.
I mean, on Wikipedia and stuff like that.
Because I got a kind of a negative impression of the author of the comics because he was kind of siding with like a lot of the people who were kind of anti-feminist about the movie.
That's another thing.
which I thought is they were sort of just like making that shit up and like, oh well, the fact that we didn't have a scene where they're being sexually assaulted means but
that's
such a such.
That's like, the thing that like, you don't
dude,
need.
Come on, like, really? You couldn't figure this out? Like, how stupid are you?
Yeah, like, I mean, honestly, to put that in the movie would be a very studio thing to do.
Well, that was something that came up in an interview with the guy who wrote the comics, and like saying basically these are like just without this sort of understanding or visualization of their assault, then they just look like spoiled princesses.
But no, you
and,
don't.
And like,
need
oh my
it.
God! I'm
like, all you need to do is like look at the reactions.
But then like, what do you think figured heavily in the comics?
Yeah,
like, there's multiple scenes of them being assaulted, right? So, like, I liked the finesse that the movie made, that the movie achieved, of getting you to understand the situation without, like we were talking before about not being gratuitous with violence and sexual violence, and like you don't have to do that stuff to get your point across if you have a good writer.
Yeah,
like like all those things can serve a purpose, but they need to serve a central purpose. Like you shouldn't be using them in a lazy way.
And it's on so many levels. Just not just it being like good writing and a good movie, but the sort of viral nature of its content, what it like.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure like chrome silver paint, spray paint sales of that skyrocketed.
You know what? One thing I loved about the movie was the religious imagery around cars and how they use the word V8 as kind of an amen.
Yeah,
like when they take the steering wheels off of the thing off the. It's basically like an altar where they're taking sacrament, right?
Yeah,
they take the steering wheels and they're all customized. They're all very individual.
Yeah,
they take the steering wheel. They have a huge reverence for it. And like, you know, by my actions.
Yeah. And that whole
so
like
I honor
when
V8.
And like
that
the whole Viking
so
mentality of like to die in battle is glory.
Oh yeah,
just
it's
like
a, it's such
witness
a,
me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's such a Nordic version of religion.
Yeah. Like, I mean even the drums and the guitar on the on the car specifically to raise morale and just get them into a battle fury.
Yeah, yeah. Berserker,
which I mean
like
even just like when you watch but when you watch the movie I said it before but couldn't help but crack a smile every time the guitar shows up. It's just like it comes up.
It's fantastic.
Oh,
I did watch the Conan O'Brien thing. You told me about.
Yeah, Conan
is amazing.
Yes. No, I think we took a wrong turn over this. It's like hanging off of the truck.
No, it's a fantastic movie. And I love the. And you're exactly right. Like the kind of and the I think that fit because it sort of jived with the idea of an apocalypse where people have basically given up, where people are sort of happy to escape living.
They've moved on. Like the civilization,
exactly.
They're not clinging to civilization.
In a way, they've kind of gone backwards into an era where being alive is sort of a curse in a horrible thing that like to be alive is pretty shitty. And so like looking forward to death and like that kind of
to die in a blaze of glory.
Dying in a blaze of glory, like that's the best thing that can happen to you. Is really appropriate and it seemed to fit the theme of the
I have something to say.
It was great.
Better to burn out and fade away. But,
yeah.
I'm sorry, quoting the Highlander. But
exactly.
Different movie, but yes.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. But everything about just I mean, it, like, even without all the like the internal message and all the finesse, it's just a fun movie.
It is.
Yeah.
And you know, when Sarah and Kat went to watch it and said it was just like not being able to catch your breath, and that is basically the reason I couldn't finish my popcorn.
Yeah,
it's just like it's just one action scene after another. It and I love the other thing I really liked about it is how quickly it got started. Like a lot of movies, the thing about world building.
Oh yeah,
the thing about world building is you. And I think this is something like Lord of the Rings and a lot of other movies did poorly, is they take so much time to build up the world that the story is taking place in, to authenticate the setting, that it becomes boring for people watching who aren't already invested in it. Like, I read Lord of the Rings when I was 10. I loved it. But I can see somebody coming into that movie and be like, what the fuck am I... why am I sitting here
watching
this short guy talk to Gandalf for 30 minutes? With Fury Road, it's obvious. Like, she's going for gas. Here's some water. Off she goes. This is a woman I trust. She gets halfway down the road and is like, fuck this. I'm gonna do something else. And then we find out why, and then the story begins. Yeah. Like, there's no... We don't have to spend all that time. And at the same time, because there's a mission or there's, like, something she has to do that's, like, you get given the impression this is a normal thing that has to happen, the world building is going on at the same time that the story is progressing, and it's very easy for the story to get started.
And also the initial world building, first off, like, the very first monologue where they talk about what happened, it's easy to understand.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's very simple. The world blew up. This, like, is the world we have now. I mean, even the end, even the stuff where it's explaining, like where Joe's offering water and people are clear, it's easy to understand. You just see it, you know instinctively what
the
is
other,
going on.
The other impression that I got right from the very start was I don't have to have seen any of the other Mad Max movies for this movie to be good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to understand anything about... No. I don't even have to understand anything about Max.
Yeah.
Like... He's continuous, but at the same time he's completely disjoint from the Mad Max from the other movies. It doesn't matter.
And it can enrich. Like, I mean, knowing that the Immortan Joe, the actor playing it, was the toe cutter from the first Mad Max.
Yeah.
Like, knowing things like that, it can enrich it.
Cute,
seeing the sort of Master Blaster sort of dichotomy between Corvus Glossus and Rectus Erectus.
Yeah.
I mean, seeing things like that, sort of homage stuff, also like stuff. Max's his jacket itself, like with the shoulder pads and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, it can enrich it, but it's not necessary.
Yeah, and so that's, I think, the sign of a good writer, a good costumer.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing, and they made it... When you make it equally accessible to fans of the series and people who are new, then you know you've done a good job.
And
I think, going in, I hadn't seen Thunderdome for...
I've only seen the first quarter.
I saw it when I was a teenager when I was babysitting one time. It was like years and years ago. I can't even remember the last time I saw it. But, you know, seeing the continuity of between that and the new movie was awesome. But at the same time, I felt like I didn't really need to see those movies. And knowing that there was a backstory to Max was cool, but
it's not
completely unnecessary. Yeah.
One thing I didn't...
I loved the actor who played... what was it?
Tom Hardy?
Tom Hardy. I loved him.
His line... Well, that one line he says, like, you know, was 160 days, like, that way? You know, I can guarantee you there's nothing but sand. And the way he says it, I don't know, it just stuck with me.
I just love how gravelly
he
was and everything. And just, like, he was so... broken.
Yeah.
He was such a good broken character. I loved it.
I mean, when he was mad and, like, yelling, like, that's my car.
That's my car!
Something like that is also fun, but the moments when he was quiet and he was just saying stuff, like, just very simple.
I think one of my favorite moments was when he was trying to use the sniper rifle. And he had got off maybe two shots and missed, and he just gives it to Furiosa.
It's just like,
and it's like, you're obviously better. He lets you just do it. Like, that acknowledgement that somebody else was better and that her being a woman didn't matter.
No,
and then he realized like, that she was better, and it was just an automatic thing. It's like, ah, you go ahead and do it. You know what you're doing. Like that kind of thing, I really liked. Like
it's his sort of knowledge of.
He's so pragmatic.
Yeah, that's exactly.
That he's sort of transcends bias.
Yeah.
I love that.
There's no pride in, like, no, I'll do this. I know how to do this. Yeah, no, it's just like, you can do it. You know how to do this better than me.
Which is exactly what you would expect in a survival situation, right? Yeah. Like, if your life depended on it and you had survived that long, you would not be clouded by judgments about, like, I'm a macho man and I can do it better than you. You'd be like, I'm going to die if I don't get a sniper rifle, so you better do it. Like, that is so much more realistic than a lot of what is shown in movies where, you know, machismo takes the front seat.
Yeah.
Right?
Or if the main character is, you know, forced to give up the kill shot, then it's a matter of circumstance and not their choice.
Right, and it's an embarrassment to them that has to be rectified later by some other act, right? Yeah. Whereas in Mad Max, it was just like a practicality. Is like, well, we're going to die if you don't shoot. So.
And, I mean, even after that with when he killed the bullet farm leader, and Jane, I also love the fact that was not shown at all.
Yeah, I love it. Like, you didn't know what he did, and you were he's like, I'll be right back. Explosion out in the fog, and they're like, yep, took care of it. Comes back with a shit ton of guns.
Right? shit ton of guns and blood on his face not his.
Fantastic.
Yes,
it's the understatement of the specifics that are fun to think about.
One thing that I found fun and funny was the fact that because Mad Max was the inspiration for the comic series and anime series Fist of the North Star, that's where it came from. I mean, the Road Warrior. Sorry, not exactly Mad Max. The Road Warrior.
So Fist of the North Star was inspired by Mad Max.
It is. Fist of the North Star, in a single phrase, is Mad Max meets Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
or you could say Bruce Lee meets Mad Max. And like so much of the imagery, especially the initial stories of Fist of the North Star, is so totally taken from. like there are characters that. There are characters that like. You obviously trace the screenshot. It's just like the character designs and things like that are so very specifically stuff from Road Warrior. And so when Mad Max Fury Road came out, when it initially started coming out, people were saying, is this a ripoff of Fist of the North Star? And I was just like, I was laughing so hard.
Juxtus.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I used to get this newsletter from this guy who lived in Japan. He's lived in Japan for like 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And he said when he started learning Japanese, he was learning from manga, and one of the first manga he read was Fist of the North Star.
Yep.
So when he was like speaking to people in everyday conversation, he was like trying to talk like the guys in Fist of the North Star. Basically came off sounding like he was going to murder everybody because his Japanese was so like just so gangster and so Yankee. It was just so bad.
Oh my, yes. Yeah, actually Fist of the North Star was one of the first manga I read.
Was it?
Yep. Right. Fist of the North Star, Dragon Ball, The Golden Age of the Jump Comics. But is there anything else you would like to add about Mad Max before we move on to our other movie?
Oh, yeah. Just in closing, I don't know. I loved the vehicle design. The prop design was incredible. I loved the way the cars were put together. Everything about it in terms of like the vehicle design was totally amazing. I love it.
Yeah. And
so like everything was so lethal looking, Mad Max movies they were sort of just like junky put together, but like every car in Fury Road, I felt like if I touch that car, it's going to kill me.
Well, it was also a lot of it was form following function. Like everything there were like you could see why it was made that
exactly,
way.
Exactly, yeah.
Why the plating was here, why the spikes are here.
You don't want people to jump onto this car because it's low to the ground.
Yeah.
This car is tall, so we're going to put gun turrets on top of it. It was very practically designed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cool. As I said, it's still in theaters in Japan this month. I might see it a third time.
I would watch it a second time. If you haven't seen it, it, you're stupid.
Yeah.
You have to go watch this movie. It's really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I wouldn't say you're stupid, but I would say you're doing yourself a massive disservice.
You're doing yourself, yeah. You're uninformed.
Yes.
Let's put it that way. Not stupid.
No. But speaking of stupid, moving
speaking
on.
Speaking of stupid, if, but... However, this next movie.
Yes. So
there may be some stupidity involved.
So the another movie we saw together was Terminator Genesis. Which is the fifth Terminator movie.
Fifth Terminator movie.
Yeah.
Which actually, like, the only reason this movie got made the way it did was because Salvation was so bad that the company basically went bankrupt.
Because, yeah.
Sell the rights to somebody else.
And then they'd written themselves completely into a corner.
Yeah.
Because, like, because each movie had basically time was on the timeline was going further and further into the future, and just like they got to a point where we're in the future now.
Yeah.
And it's just like, uh-oh.
Well, we caused the thing that we didn't want to happen,
and
reboot. I guess that's it.
Yeah. Just like it was the only way to fix it would be a reboot. And honestly, their method was really good. Mm. I will say that. I will give them that.
Yeah, I won't lie. I think I had a good time during this movie. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed Terminator Genesis, but it was problematic.
Yeah, as like, flawed as it was, I had fun.
It was fun.
Yeah. But I would say that, like, that the idea of just like going back, and because it's a time travel, it's always been a time travel series. The only one that wasn't was Salvation,
mm-hmm.
and that was the one that fucked everything up.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you could argue that 3 also fucked things up, mm-hmm. but 3, personally, I like 3. Mm-hmm. The way it ends, it is perfect because the inevitability of it, which I really
enjoyed. I felt like Genesis was sort of a gratuitous retcon.
Yeah, it was. It felt forced, but at the same time, it felt needed.
As retcons go. Yeah. I feel like it was like what they needed to do to make up for 4.
Yeah, it felt a lot like the J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboot.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this is something because the series itself has kind of become stagnant.
Yeah, it's petered out.
It's like it's run out of stuff to do, but they found a way to organically, quote unquote, organically.
Having
reboot
said
it.
That,
yeah.
The number of continuity problems in this movie is so huge that I don't even, like, I tried to start thinking about them, and my brain sort of just melted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another thing that I really liked was the painstaking manner in which they recreated stuff from Terminator 1.
Yeah.
The 80s world where they, like, they recreated scenes.
It's quite obvious that they're, like, running out of 80s props.
Yeah.
It was, like, really difficult to procure enough.
Yeah. Although the very first, the garbage disposal guy, when Arnold, the first Arnold shows up and he goes, what the hell? It wasn't the same guy. He didn't do it in that same iconic, what the hell?
What the hell?
That's all he said. I think he says that 3 times in the first movie. And unfortunately, they didn't go that far.
But I have to say, the CGI young Arnold at the beginning, I worry for the careers of actual actors.
Mm.
Like
that was really good.
The CGI
good.
Of Arnold at the beginning of that movie, looking like he did in the beginning of the first Terminator movie,
that
almost 100% convincing.
Yeah.
Like, so realistic. I couldn't believe how realistic that looked. It was, you know, maybe 10 years from now I'll look back on it, but it's gotten to a point of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
It's like they're working on that one last 1% of the
it uncanny valley. It went beyond, for me, it went beyond the uncanny valley. It was no longer in there. It was like...
It was believable.
Yeah, I had no
it was
problem.
Really believable.
And, I think, what was, Joe, Bob Chipman, with Movie Bob, he has a podcast. He in his critique of the movie, he said, like, they took all the things that everybody loved from the first two movies. Basically, like, you want to see Arnold. You want to see the CGI young Arnold. So they put that in there. You want to see the T-1000 from the Terminator 2. We put that in there.
Yep.
We want to see Arnold, like, Arnold Terminator as a good guy. We put that in there. Like, basically, it's fan service, the movie.
but I mean,
but and that's what, I'll say that's true.
The Generation X generation, that's what they want.
That's the thing.
They want Ninja Turtles and Smurfs and breakfast cereal, and they want all the shit that makes them forget that they have a shitty job. like going back and reliving those kind of movies is what middle-aged people live for now. So I can understand the appeal, and I enjoyed it specifically for that, but... It was a good mark of a good movie that they repeated the things that were good. It wasn't anything original, but it was good.
One huge problem I had was how less convincing Sarah Connor was at looking at her age, her supposed age.
Emilia Clarke is too young. I think she's a decent actor, but. In that she looks like she's about 17.
Yeah, she does not like Sarah Connor. I'm not sure what Sarah Connor's actual age was supposed to be in the original movie, in the first movie, but she looked out of college, maybe mid-20s,
if that.
Yeah, and
I think I mean,
I wouldn't be surprised if she was going on late 20s, early 30s, possibly.
I think it also commits one of the sort of cardinal sins of action movies in that. Sort of like the movie Kick-Ass, where what's the girl's name?
Hit Girl.
Hit Girl.
Yeah.
She's trained by her father, Nicolas Cage, who was a former police officer, to be a badass since she was born. And now she can, take out multiple people at once. Like, she has her superpowers for no reason. In the same respect, Emilia Clarke's Sarah Connor is, a killing badass.
Who can hold up a Desert Eagle with one hand. I do not. That is the least convincing thing.
She's a badass for no other reason than the fact that a T-800 has trained her for a few years of her life. You can't display that kind of superhuman ability just because you've been trained from childhood. You are still fighting against
your muscle. and you do not look like your muscles have fully developed.
You cannot hold up a Desert Eagle pistol with one hand and just shoot like that. That is, I think, a cardinal sin of action movies is that they don't explain a lot of times. The fantastical ones don't explain where people's powers come from, other than that I've trained my whole life.
Yeah,
that's not an excuse. That's not good enough
for the powers that you're displaying.
For the powers that you've displayed, that's not a good enough excuse to explain your powers.
Maybe if
you train for 30 years, you might be.
Maybe if you were 20 years older, but or at least looked 20 years older.
If you looked 20 years older, and you didn't look like you were 17, But I thought, you know, aside from the sort of unbelievability of her powers, Emilia Clarke did a pretty good job. I thought she was a pretty good actor in it.
I do like the creative stuff they did with the T-1000.
Yeah, that was really cool. But at the same time, it was we're a lot better at coming up with cool ideas we can do with CGI now, because we can do them.
Yeah.
Let's think of some cool things we can do with the T-1000.
But that's also, that falls back on, the biggest fault that the series has had ever since Terminator 2 Judgment Day, is that they can't create a Terminator more iconic than the T-1000.
Yeah, that's true.
They tried that with a...
It can take any form. It can do anything.
Yeah.
Can it be better than that?
It's like they tried that with Terminator 3 with the TX. Nope, they failed.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing they could
do...
What was
the difference there?
It was basically, it was a standard, it was a T-800 coated with the T-1000, the liquid metal.
Okay.
So it was a hybrid, basically, that it would have, which had more weaponry pre-installed.
Do we want to talk about problems?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
So the new Terminator, the latest Terminator, the John Connor. Okay, wait, sorry. This is actually not a problem. The fact that they, in the movie, that they got rid of the John Connor mythos. They deconstructed it.
Yep.
They got rid of it. So now the future no longer hinges on John Connor.
So basically,
Connor.
Sarah is John.
Yeah, they don't need. So up until now, every movie has always been about save John. The first movie
was
about
the other guy's name?
Kyle Reese.
Kyle.
Yeah.
So basically, Kyle can use a condom now. He's cool.
Yeah. But, like, the first movie was about saving John, saving his mother to have John. The
right.
second movie about saving John. The third movie is about letting John survive the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. The fourth movie is about John. And so it's, like, it's always been about... But the fifth movie is just like, forget about... Let's forget about John.
Let's talk about Sarah.
Yeah, John is no longer important anymore.
Let's send Kyle back to fall in love with Sarah, and then they can walk off.
Yeah, and they got rid of that, which is why I did appreciate that they can take the lore in a different direction now.
Yeah, that is kind of cool. Like, the fact that it's an alternate timeline means that John doesn't... Like, the idea that John doesn't have to exist for them to avoid Judgment Day is it's kind of a cool idea. I like that.
That said, John, the new John Terminator was a little wonky.
I didn't like the whole it's a virus.
Magnets, how do they work?
It's like, no, seriously, it's like they just stole a bunch of shit from the Matrix and now it's a computer program or some shit.
It's nanomachines.
You get from touching someone.
Yeah.
Okay, fuck off.
You get from touching the doctor.
Yeah.
Doctor Who, but Matt Smith. Another thing, this is another thing I always run into with the computer's hyper-evolving intelligences, where it starts as a child, and then, like, in a few scenes, it's, like, it's a young man, and then it slowly grows older, and then it's like, so when's it going to become a wrinkled old hag? Or like a crone?
Or also, like an old... Do you think computers would not figure this shit out faster than us? Like, they don't have to go through an aging process. They just rewrite their code. Like,
yeah, and it's just
this is just temporally convenient for our audience.
Yeah, it's visually sort of representing the evolution, it never goes past the man in his prime age. It never turns into a raisin.
Good. It's like, always a man.
Yeah. Good point. Mm. But the fact that they've kept that part open, the Skynet part open, not bad, but still.
Toshi, why was the Terminator assembly plant inside the time?
Yeah, why was the T-1000 experimental T-1000
construction
plant in the time machine chamber?
That seems like a conflict. That seems like a problem.
Yeah, it's like
an unnecessary problem.
Yeah, I'm going to keep my nuclear materials next to my TNT.
The excuse I saw on Reddit was that this was like security for the time machine. I'm like, okay, well, like they could just be in the next building and walk over.
Yeah,
it's like there's no reason for this to happen in the building with the time machine.
And the fact that the T-1000s are useless without a CPU that doesn't exist. And also that was another thing is the fact that maybe we already said spoilers. So Arnie Terminator gets blown up and then he falls into the vat into the pool of T-1000 material.
Mm-hmm.
And the logic is that his CPU basically powers and reconstructs himself as a T-1000. It's just like, is that how that works? All you need to do is drop a CPU inside liquid metal, and it becomes.
That also sort of trivializes the development of the T-1000.
Yeah, it's just like you can use a T-800.
Well, we have this. We came up with this material, this like magic metallic goo. We just push a bunch of T-800s into and now they're suddenly T-1000.
Yes, and like also the fact that
easiest upgrade ever,
and it needs a CPU. For example, when the original the T-1000 like it got shot and like blasted into pieces and all that shit happened to it.
Which piece of
where was the CPU?
Fortunately, it didn't get hit.
No, yes.
It's like the only way we can make a Terminator is to have an obsolete CPU.
Yeah, and
Moore's law is definitely over. we've accomplished the maximum we're possible with the T-800.
Now, I actually want to bring up. Do you have any other at the very problematic stuff you want to mention?
Other than the totally confused timeline, which I can't make heads or tails of
anymore
because I haven't been thinking about it long enough to actually come up with objections. But yeah,
okay,
it was like when the Terminator showed up and choked John in the very beginning when Kyle was going back in the time machine, and I'm like, okay, like where is this coming from? This is never explained.
Yeah.
Like, okay, whatever. I just can't be bothered with the timeline in Terminator anymore. It's so convoluted. Like every movie they make makes the timeline worse.
Yeah.
To be honest. Which is why I'm kind of thankful for this reboot.
Yeah, they've cleansed everything beyond the modern.
Throw away the crap from Salvation. and just say, oh, we're in a different timeline. Okay, fine. I can accept that. But still, the movie has problems. But yeah, other than that, I don't have any real criticisms. I mean, Arnold's retcon of like, oh, I'm getting older because my flesh is getting older. Yeah,
that works. I'll give him that.
I'll give him that, but it's still kind of funny.
It's like, because
yeah, Arnold, you're old fucker.
Okay, here's something I've noticed that no one has mentioned. Maybe someone has, but I haven't encountered. I've actually looked for it specifically on the internet, and I haven't found anybody mention this. So the logic is that this is never covered in the movie. They gloss over it. Is that Arnold, quote unquote, pops Terminator? The good Arnold is at some point in the future. He's reprogrammed, sent back in time to save Sarah Connor as a child, and then he raises her and trains her and all that stuff like that. But the thing is, like, by who? And they never. That's something they're probably going to save for down the line. They haven't even thought of it. But one thing I did notice that nobody has mentioned is when Sarah is recounting her first meeting with Pop's Terminator, is when her parents died. And she was vacationing at like a lake house with her parents, and then the house blows up all of a sudden.
Right.
And then the boat she's in with her dad suddenly starts sinking, but it's not filling with water, it's filling with this liquid metal. And her dad basically gets her into the water and says, you know, swim, don't look back, just swim. She swims to the docks, and then there's Arnold showing. He shows up with a smoking bazooka, and he rescues her.
Mm-hmm.
Who killed Sarah Connor's parents?
Good point.
I will say that the T-1000 probably killed her dad. But the house exploding...
Or Arnold destroyed the T-1000 with the bazooka.
That's the thing. He shows up, but...
And blew up the house before.
That's the thing.
So
it's like,
he killed them both.
Exactly. Because, like, the T-1000s we've seen what the movie has laid out, they use guns when they have to, but they generally rely on their own shape-shifting abilities to create their own weapons, stuff like that, pointed knives.
They only use weapons when they're confronted with superior forces.
Yeah, or when it serves their purpose.
Yep.
But as far as the movie is laid out, they never use explosives. What blew up the cabin? And the cabin blew up, and the boat started sinking. The T-1000 was not...
The fact that it happened at the same time means that the T-1000 was already there.
In the boat. So something else must have blown up her cabin. The way I see it is Arnold killed Sarah Connor's parents.
Yeah. You're totally right.
but now the question is, why did it save Sarah Connor? If it was there to save Sarah Connor, then why did he kill her parents? And I think that actually lays a groundwork for something interesting they can do later.
Hmm. Well, there's going to be another movie. I think there's already confirmed that Arnold's going to be in at least one more Terminator movie. So, yeah.
But
hopefully that'll be the last one. I like the Terminator franchise, but it's so much better suited to comics than movies, just because Arnold is such a central character to it.
Yeah, he's become so iconic.
He cannot do any more movies. I think he did a pretty good job for this one, for being as old as he was.
Yeah.
I don't think 10 years from now, he's still alive, he's not going to be able to do another one.
All his latest action movies all center... His character in all his latest movies have centered around being old.
Yeah, that's true.
What was it? Sabotage.
Well, give him that. He knows how to play his role.
I mean, Expendables.
I wish he'd do some other movies, because actually, I don't think he's that bad of an actor. He's got a very specific role.
Yeah, he's been typecast, and it's
the meathead action guy, and
who has talks with a funny Austrian accent.
Yeah, but I think there's other roles he could fulfill, and I think he's pretty good in those roles. I think he could still make movies. He just needs to stop making Terminator pretty soon.
Yeah, but yeah, that's something I noticed that in the theater, like. Because when Sarah Connor was talking about what happened, and I was just and Arnold, it shows that scene where Arnold's walking in slow mo and he's carrying the smoking bazooka, and I'm just like, did he blow up her cabin? It was just Did art? And I was through the rest of the movie, I was wondering if that was going to come up. So it's like, wait,
I hope they don't play that off as like the T-1000 was in the cabin and he blew up the cabin to kill the T-1000, and then the T-1000 like ran out into the lake somehow.
It'd be much more interesting to me if there was an ulterior motive.
Killed her parents
because he needed to raise her for some other reason, and that was his programming.
Yeah,
and it makes it much more interesting because
I hope it wasn't just trying to pursue the T-1000.
Yeah, I mean because they've started in this movie. They did it in T2 also, but like trying to make Arnold's Terminator have emotions and be more human.
I did kind of like the humor in this one about him smiling.
Yeah, and every time he tries to smile,
I'm trying
it's creepy.
To teach him, but it's like it's still super creepy. I think that also was sort of poignant in the fact in sort of addressing the uncanny valley between androids and humans.
Yeah.
And that we're all very aware of now.
And the movie, they try to make it like that Arnold's Pops Terminator actually loves Sarah.
Yeah.
And they really heavily leaned on that. Mm. But I think it's always much more interesting when he's just a machine.
Yeah.
And it's part of his programming.
One of the more interesting scenes I thought was when Kyle and him were reloading the weapons. And they were having a contest.
Basically, seeing
who could reload them faster. I thought that was actually kind of an interesting scene in that, like, they didn't show Arnold reloading the weapons in, like, a superhuman speed.
Yeah.
Like, he had sort of, like, limitations.
Yeah.
Right?
But he was very meticulous. He was a machine.
He was a machine, but he wasn't, like, superhumanly fast.
No, he was exact, though. Yeah, it's just like, okay, this guy,
But he's also, like, malfunctioning at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, he can't actually, like, he's sort of wearing out.
Yeah.
I like the fact that they showed him as kind of like a mortal and not just like an immortal machine.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, it kind of lent to his humanization.
Yeah.
I like that they were showing him develop as a person, but also sort of degrading as an old person, which was really kind of a nice homage to the whole series of him getting older.
Which is another one of my personal reasons why I don't think the robot apocalypse will ever happen, because I've never seen a CPU last more than 10 years.
Yeah, that just assumes that there won't be robots to repair on.
Yes.
I think they will anticipate this problem.
But still, like I've never seen anything with a CPU more complex than a hand calculator last more than 10 years.
True. I still got my TI-92 up there on the cupboard. Still works.
Well, my original PlayStation 1 also still works. But still, just like something...
I still got an 8-bit NES that still works.
But like something with the complexity of an AI.
Of course,
A CPU for an AI lasting...
With hundreds of billions of transistors.
Yeah.
It's not going to last that long.
No.
Without maintenance, yeah.
Yeah. The whole thing of the robot apocalypse is that like robots are immortal, they don't die, but yeah. So I also talk about Terminator, Mad Max, Fury Road, and Terminator Genesis.
Yep.
Very spoiler laden. Thank you for sticking around for people who don't mind spoilers. And so I'm Toshi.
I'm Tony.
And we'll catch you next time.
Thank you.